Today's Saturday matinee is special as it comes from another podcast available to listen to ad-free at IntoHistory.com. What is Into History? I'm glad you asked. Into History is a podcast subscription network I built to showcase some of the best history content out there from true, diehard, independent history creators. History Daily is available there, ad-free, but also some amazing other shows, also ad-free, and often with bonus content, like my good friend Professor Greg Jackson's History That Doesn't Suck, or the always thrilling Cold War Conversations with Ian Sanders. Even my recent re-release of American Elections Wiki Game is there, all 159 episodes bingeable right now. In fact, there are a dozen podcast feeds available at IntoHistory.com, including today's spotlight podcast, Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. When I was a little boy, there was one painting at the Dallas Museum of Art that always captivated me, The Icebergs by Frederick Edwin Church from 1861. Church was a prominent participant in the Hudson River School of American landscape painters, creating large, incredibly detailed and romantic paintings of sweeping landscapes, and The Icebergs is no different. Looking at it, you can feel the cold luminescence of the ice, the forbidding barrenness. And just at the bottom of the painting, almost out of frame, is the shattered mast of some poor ship. In 1863, 2 years after the painting was first completed, Church would add this detail to tap into the tragic tale of British Captain Sir John Franklin's 1845 failed attempt to map and navigate the Northwest Passage. Captain and all his men perished in icy Canadian waters, but Church, trying to capitalize on British fascination with the wrecks, added the broken mast of a ship in the foreground of his painting as a direct allusion to the doomed expedition, just before shipping the painting off for an exhibition in London to be attended by Arctic explorers, as well as the widowed wife of Captain Franklin. I didn't know any of this, of course, when I was just 8, admiring the painting. I only knew it looked cool, and that shipwreck, barely in frame, told some sort of story of misery and mystery. Here to tell another tale of misery and mystery in icy Canadian waters is Rich Napolitano from the podcast Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. In the early morning hours of May 29, 1914, the ship Empress of Ireland collided with another in dense fog on the St. Lawrence River. No iceberg was involved this time, but over 1,000 people on board perished, more than the Titanic just 2 years prior. And because of this massive loss of life, the Empress has been called Canada's Titanic. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, head to IntoHistory.com and subscribe to get more ad-free history content, and be sure to search for and follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
I saw visions of doomsday. But looking out through the skylight, I saw frantic seamen rushing to the ship's side, sliding down and, as often as not, being dashed headfirst into the sea. In a flash, I saw what had happened. Literally tearing my wife from her berth, I dashed onto the deck, and we both slid down the deck and were projected into the water. Then followed moments that no man could ever describe. Half drunk as I was with sleep, the sudden and terrible awakening produced an indescribable effect on me. For a moment, I saw nothing but dirty gray. I struggled wildly for the surface, and the time seemed like years. As soon as I got to the surface, I saw my wife struggling beside me. Right at our side was a deserted lifeboat, which must have been broken from its davits. I managed to push my wife into it, but was unable to follow myself. So I shouted to my wife to sit tight, and that I would swim until I was picked up. The last lifeboat was only a few yards away from me, passing by the side of the sinking Empress, when suddenly a huge, heavy superstructure broke from the steamer's side, falling with a terrible crash into the boat. I shut my eyes in horror. When I looked up again, all that was left of the lifeboat and her 45 occupants were a few stumps of wreckage. Poor people, they had gone to their doom. Fortunately, death was sudden and merciful. A few minutes afterwards, I was picked up by one of the boats from the Storstad. I cannot express the joy and relief. This was the account of survivor John W. Black of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. The Empress of Ireland, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome everyone to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventures. Today I'm going to discuss the Empress of Ireland, often called Canada's Titanic. It was a terrible tragedy with much loss of life. The Empress of Ireland was a passenger steamship built for the Canadian Pacific Railway in Glasgow, Scotland. She would operate under the subsidiary company, Canadian Pacific Steamship Company. She and her sister ship, the Empress of Britain, were built specifically to meet the increasing demand of immigration to Canada in the early 20th century, providing weekly service across the Atlantic. Dan Conlon, curator of the Canadian Immigration Museum at Pier 21 in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Well, they represented really the maturity and the potential of Canada, a newly created country. And the Canadian Pacific Railway was a real national kind of landmark. It had built a transcontinental railway in 1885 that brought in the western provinces to Canada and opened up millions and millions of square kilometers to settlement in the west, also displacing large numbers of Indigenous people. But such was the nature of colonization at the time. And CPR was a very ambitious company. They were far more than a railway. They also owned millions of acres of land. They built hotel chains, and they saw the long game in terms of if they could promote immigration, they could sell land to immigrants. They could then get the business of immigrants exporting their wheat and cattle for the rest of the life of the immigrants, and then they get all that railway business, as well as get their steamship tickets to come to Canada. So it was a very horizontally integrated company. Building the two Empress's ships in 1904 was kind of a major acceleration of the company. They had this transcontinental railway. They had amazing steamship connections on the Pacific. And then in 1904, they just decided, well, let's take on the transatlantic, the most lucrative passenger market in the shipping world. And so that would put them in competition, with big players like Cunard and White Star Line. But CPR was part of their kind of plan to become a global transportation company. And they knew that immigration was key, that those big, glorious floating palaces like Mauritania, Lusitania, Titanic, you think of the glamorous first-class passengers, but the money-making was in third class, where you could sell a large number of tickets, and CPR knew that. Their role in promoting immigration was really key to Canada. This was an era, the peak years of immigration. We think we have a lot of immigrants coming to North America now. It's nothing compared to that turn of the century land boom in Western North America. And CPR was an enormous part of that. And these two ships would allow them to compete and bring large numbers of immigrants back and forth across the Atlantic. So it was a big investment for the company. And it was a prestige thing for a lot of Canadians. The idea that a Canadian company would be a big player with the American-owned and the British liners and the French and the German liners that were the amazing technology of their day. And you could also see that in places like Halifax and St. John, New Brunswick, who were competing to be the winter port for the Empress ships. Come summertime, they were going up the St. Lawrence River to Quebec City. In the wintertime, both my home port of Halifax and then the rival port, they all wanted the Empress to come. So they were great status ships and marked a major investment for, corporate, but also a national Canada at that time period.
The two ships were launched a month apart in 1906, both setting speed records. And the ships generated much publicity. Both were 167 meters long with a beam or width of 20 meters. Their seven decks reached 14 meters above the waterline, and both could reach speeds up to 20 knots. The ships were inspected by Lloyd's of London from the laying down of the keel throughout the entire construction and were in compliance with all regulations for passenger ships. Safety was much considered in the design of the Empress. After the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, safety regulations were changed for passenger ships, including mandating enough lifeboats for all on board. The Empress of Ireland was equipped with 40 lifeboats, enough for 1,686 people. Room for 280 more than the ship's maximum capacity. Additionally, the ship carried 24 life buoys with 2,212 life jackets, including 150 children's life jackets. The ships were also designed with 11 watertight bulkheads and could stay afloat even if two of the bulkheads were damaged. The Empress was equipped with modern technology as well, including a Marconi wireless telegraph system and underwater iceberg detecting sonar. 24 watertight doors allowed passage throughout the ship and could be closed to prevent flooding from spreading throughout the ship. However, these doors had to be manually operated, a weakness that will prove to be critical. Henry George Kendall began his career as a mariner at age 14, and by age 20 was an officer on board the SS Lusitania when it was wrecked off the coast of Newfoundland. Now, this was not the better-known RMS Lusitania, which was torpedoed by a German submarine in 1915. Kendall then spent time working directly with Guglielmo Marconi to develop the first-ever ship-to-shore radio. In 1910, Kendall was promoted to captain of the SS Montrose. And during his time on the Montrose, he achieved a bit of fame. During a voyage aboard the Montrose, Kendall recognized Dr. Hawley Harvey Crippen, also known as the London Cellar Murderer, despite Crippen having shaved his mustache and grown a beard. Crippen was joined by his mistress, Ethel Lenev, also disguised as a young boy. Kendall saw right through these disguises and used his Marconi radio to notify British authorities that Crippen was on board the Montrose, which was headed to Canada. Chief Inspector Walter Dew pursued the Montrose on the faster SS Laurentic of the White Star Line, arriving in Quebec ahead of the Montrose. Posing as a harbor pilot, the chief inspector boarded the Montrose and arrested the couple. Lenev was acquitted of being an accessory to murder, but Crippen was convicted and hanged in November of 1910. It was the first instance of a radio being used to capture a wanted criminal. Henry George Kendall was made captain of the Empress of Ireland in 1914, and later the same year on May 28th, Kendall embarked on his very first Atlantic crossing as a ship's master. For the Empress of Ireland, it was her 96th Atlantic crossing. Its six-day journey included 2 days on the St. Lawrence River before heading east for Liverpool. She left Quebec City at 4:30 p.m. on May 28th with 1,477 people on board and 1,100 tons of cargo, including 252 ingots of silver and 2,600 tons of coal.
Well, they were really well planned and carefully planned. You know, they weren't as big as the big four stackers. So Empress of Ireland comes in about 550 feet long, and, you know, Mauritania, the same period, is 780 feet long. So they're a bit smaller, at two stacks instead of four stacks, but carefully designed to give you all that floating palace luxury you would have on a bigger ship, but on a smaller, more economical ship. And the CPR, you know, worked with the shipbuilders on the Clyde in Scotland to carefully design a ship that had, you know, everything you would expect to see on any of the big four stackers, you know, a sensational dining room with, you know, a two-story balcony and an amazing oval decorative skylight and 560 volume library and an in-house band and a music room and, the film projecting theaters and health spa, all that sort of floating palace stuff on a sort of a slightly smaller vessel. But they also, carefully looked at steam powered plants. I mean, steam turbines were the wonder of the age for fast ships like Mauritania, Lusitania, but CPR wanted them to make money. And so they went with, you know, just some quadruple expansion engines, which, you know, would deliver a very respectable 20 knots, not as fast as, say, the 23 knots that you were getting from the four stackers like Mauritania and Lusitania, but burned a lot less coal. So these ships would be much more efficient.
Immediately after departing Quebec City, crew members carefully instructed all passengers to the locations of the lifeboats and informed every passenger of the lifebelts stored in their cabins. Earlier that morning, before the ship's departure, the crew of the Empress were put through lifeboat launching exercises, fire drills, and other drills to close the watertight hatches. These exercises were performed before every transatlantic crossing, and the crew performed these duties in just 3 minutes. It took 10 crew members to launch each lifeboat, and each of the ship's 24 watertight doors was assigned to a specific crew member who was responsible for manually closing it when the alarm was sounded. On board the Empress of Ireland were Laurence Irving and Mabel Hackney, famous British actors who were also husband and wife. They traveled in first class, of course, and their cabin was one deck below the lifeboats. Irving was very much looking forward to the trip, but Hackney disliked ocean travel and suffered from seasickness. Also on board was Frank Ernest Abbott, a successful businessman and a British immigrant to Canada. With his brother Arthur, Abbott co-owned a Toronto-based millinery company designing and manufacturing women's hats. He often traveled to London to discover new fashion trends and fabrics. Second-class passengers enjoyed accommodations almost as nice as first-class. Among the second-class passengers were Bill and Emma Hart, and their two children, Edith and Bill. They were a working-class family traveling from rural Saskatchewan. Bill ran a butcher shop back home, and he and his family were taking a pleasure trip on the Empress. 171 members of the Salvation Army were also on board. The group was traveling to London to attend the organization's International Congress. The Salvation Army band happily played as other passengers boarded. The 717 third-class passengers were largely laid-off workers from the Ford plant in Detroit. Left without jobs, many of these passengers were heading back home to Europe in search of work.
CPR really knew that immigration was your moneymaker, and they put a lot of thought into the third-class immigration accommodation aboard the ship. The two Empress ships were kind of a bit of breakthrough in terms of almost all the third-class accommodation was cabins. In an era when there was a lot of North Atlantic liners still had these open-deck dormitory styles with no privacy, CPR wanted to attract, you know, the top immigrant traffic, so they had third-class cabins. They were clever enough, though, to have sort of modular cabins. If there was a real rush, they could convert cabins to open-deck space. And they even had some quite, they had one deck of third-class cabins that could be converted to cargo space instead of cabins during the winter months when passenger traffic was kind of slower.
The first evening aboard the Empress was very pleasant and calm. Passengers mingled while children explored the ship and played. Later, the passengers filled the dining halls with third-class dining at 5 p.m. and second- and first-class dining at 7 p.m. By 10 o'clock p.m., most of the passengers had retired to their cabins, expecting only a peaceful first night. Despite the late hour, Captain Kendall remained on the bridge to guide the Empress out of the port and out into open water. At 1:20 a.m. on May 29th, the Empress dropped off its river pilot, Adéard Bernier, at Pointe au Père, along the eastern shore of the river. As the Empress pulled away, First Officer Edward John Jones spotted another ship about 8 miles north and informed Captain Kendall. This was the SS Storstad, a Norwegian collier, or coal carrier, which was inbound to Montreal.
Yes, this is very much a St. Lawrence River story. The St. Lawrence has its own hazards. It's a long river, it has some serious sandbars, it has dangerous currents, and especially it has a lot of fog. You got a mixture of warm air, cold air. Fog is a real killer in this era before radar and also vessel-to-vessel communication. Ships are just groping in the darkness, making assumptions about where other vessels are. And that was the key factor in this terrible tragedy. Empress of Ireland was outbound going down the river and had just dropped off the mail and was kind of nearing the coming into the Gulf of St. Lawrence where the river widens dramatically, but she was still in the narrow section. It was up till then a clear, warm night. Warm enough that a lot of people had portholes open. It was clear and they could see the lights of another ship inbound coming up the river. And then the fog comes in and shuts both ships off from each other.
The Storstad was heading for Pointe au Père to take on the pilot who would guide the ship to the port in Montreal. Captain of the Storstad, Thomas Anderson, had retired for the night at 11 p.m. His second officer remained on duty until midnight when First Officer Alfred Toftenus took over. The inbound Storstad and the outbound Empress of Ireland were approaching each other head-on, although still a good distance apart. The rules of the road dictated a port-to-port passing for ships approaching each other in this situation. However, Captain Kendall determined there was plenty of distance between the Empress and the Storstad, so he ordered a turn to port to head for open waters, which would cut across the path of the Storstad. While the ships could have potentially passed port-to-port, it would have put the Empress very close to shore for Captain Kendall's liking, not to mention off his intended course. The Empress gained speed and headed northwest, intending for a starboard-to-starboard passing. Just as Kendall ordered this change in course, a heavy fog blanketed both ships, reducing visibility to virtually zero. Because of this, Kendall was not confident of the Storstad's position, but believed it was safe to continue. On the Storstad, First Officer Toftenus was unaware of the new course taken by the Empress and did not know her exact position. As far as he knew, the Empress had stayed on course closer to shore for a port-to-port passing. Concerned about the fog, Kendall ordered the Empress to slow and then full astern in order to stop the ship. And the Empress sounded three blasts of the ship's whistle. He then ordered full stop and gave two blasts of the ship's whistle to indicate to the Storstad that the Empress was dead in the water. This was standard procedure for ships operating in limited visibility conditions. The crew of the Empress of Ireland claimed to have heard a whistle from the Storstad in acknowledgement. First Officer Toftinus on the Storstad was also concerned about passing too close to the Empress of Ireland, which he assumed was still hugging the coast. The fog eliminated any visual contact, so in order to put some space between his ship and the Empress, he ordered a slight course change to starboard, toward the west, away from the coast. Unknowingly, he was now headed directly for the new course of the Empress of Ireland.
The two captains made different choices about what course to pursue. They thought they were pulling further away from each other, but they actually made separate choices that brought them closer and closer together. But they didn't know this until they were just meters away in the fog, and Storstad looms up in front of Empress of Ireland. So it was really the fog that led to this disaster. And I'm always reminding people this is an era where you don't have vessel-to-vessel communication. Empress had a wonderful state-of-the-art wireless set, but Storstad was a cargo ship, didn't have wireless. So you couldn't talk to the other ship. You could only communicate through whistle blasts. And they provide a limited amount of information. I'm turning to port. I'm turning to starboard. I'm reversing. Get out of the way. The two vessels had a very little capacity to reverse that ominous drawing together that happened in the fog that early morning of May the 29th.
Minutes later, Kendall saw two masthead lights off his starboard bow through the thick haze about 100 meters away. He quickly came to the realization that a collision was imminent and unavoidable. He ordered engines full and a hard turn to starboard, hoping the angle of the collision would produce only a glancing blow. But the size of the ships and the momentum eliminated any hope of avoiding a collision. The Storstad smashed into the starboard side of the Empress, slicing through the hull of the ship with ease. The Storstad had a reinforced hull meant for breaking through the ice in the North Atlantic. The Storstad cut an enormous gash into the Empress, about 5 meters wide and 14 meters high. 60,000 gallons of cold water per second gushed into the Empress. Most aboard were already sound asleep in their cabins when the collision occurred. A distress call using the Marconi radio was immediately sent by the Empress following the collision, and it was picked up by the Port Au Pair station. Sergeant Benjamin John Fowler, member of the Salvation Army Band in Toronto, later said, "I was in my cabin at the center of the boat down below, in third class. I couldn't sleep. Still too excited about the trip, I was looking out the porthole trying to make out the lights on the shore, but it was foggy. Suddenly I saw emerging from the darkness an even darker mass. It was a few feet from the hull. This is what I believed at first, but with the mist it was hard to say. Then there was a jolt. Not a crashing noise, no, like a kind of creaking. There was hardly time to take in what had just happened when the water started to come into my cabin. There wasn't a minute to lose. I rushed outside toward the main staircase. I ran into a woman who was holding a baby in her arms. Next to her was a child of about 6. She begged me to help her inflate a life vest. I stopped and took the time to help her. Another passenger, Walter Erzinger from Winnipeg, was a second-class passenger. It must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning. I was awoken by a loud noise and a violent impact. I suddenly thought, we have just hit an iceberg. It felt like the boat was leaning on its side. I jumped out of my berth. I pulled on my pants. I picked up 2 life vests. I did this because, with the angle on the floor, I could see very clearly that something was going wrong. I threw a life vest to my cabin mate and rushed into the passageway. Other passengers were running around the outside. Some of them had forgotten their life belts. I shouted, "Bring your life belts!" The water was coming in through the portholes. The boat was listing more and more. The passageways quickly filled up. The passengers had to fight against the current. Several were not able to get to the deck in time. We heard women and children screaming. It was terrible. Men, as courageous as they were generous, tried to help them, but it all happened so fast. It was impossible to do any more. Suddenly, an officer cried out, "Everyone must do what he can to save himself." I will never forget this order. It was the last. time to strike the sails for an ad break. The alarm on the Empress was sounded, and all crew members assigned to closing the watertight doors immediately ran to their posts. Many of those areas were already flooded, making it impossible to access the watertight doors. The collision occurred so suddenly and unpredictably that the crew had almost no time to close them before the oncoming water overtook the ship. The Storstad cut through the Empress so easily and deeply that it broke through the watertight bulkhead between two boiler rooms. The boilers were already on fire but were overcome by water within 2 minutes, extinguishing those fires. As pressure dropped in the boilers, the ship lost power and its ability to maneuver. The Empress of Ireland had a wireless Marconi radio, however the Storstad did not. So Captain Kendall attempted to communicate with the Storstad using a megaphone, requesting the Storstad stay lodged inside the Empress in order to prevent more water from gushing in. But Captain Kendall was not able to reach the Storstad. The strong current of the St. Lawrence and the momentum of the Storstad forced the ship to rotate from its bow to face the opposite direction, before being pushed out of and away from the Empress. With the hull now unplugged, the frigid water of the St. Lawrence River gushed into the Empress. She listed badly to starboard, making it nearly impossible to launch the portside lifeboats. Only 5 lifeboats on the starboard side were able to be launched, and only a small number of people found their way into them. Those in the lower deck simply had no chance. Others flung themselves overboard to get away from the sinking ship, most without life jackets. Lawrence Irving, Mabel Hackney, and Frank Ernest Abbott, our first-class passengers mentioned earlier, darted out of their suites and into the passageway. The three decide to make a break for the top deck, but there was much panic and confusion among all the passengers. Lawrence Irving was thrown violently down in the fray, and he broke his nose. Frank Abbott then assisted him and helped he and his wife Mabel into their life jackets. He watched as the two of them scrambled desperately to the top deck. The second class Hart family found themselves up to their knees in water in almost no time. In the dark confines of their flooded cabin, they didn't know what to do. Some of the third class passengers were able to climb up the slippery stairs and make it to the deck. By that time, the ship was listing so badly it was difficult to find footing. Frank Abbott finally made it to the deck himself, but once there, he was forced to jump into the freezing river. He was pulled under multiple times trying to reach the lifeboats, until he was finally able to grab onto some floating debris. On the Storstad, the crew quickly assessed the damage of their ship. It was determined that while the bow was badly damaged, the ship was in no danger of sinking. The Storstad's crew then immediately launched their 4 lifeboats and began pulling people out of the frigid water. 10 minutes after the collision, the Empress suddenly jolted and rolled on its starboard side, floating helplessly and half-submerged. Those who were struggling on the deck were hurled into the water, including Captain Kendall, who made it to a lifeboat and eventually on board the Storstad. He immediately began blaming the captain of the Storstad, shouting, "You sunk my ship!" an accusation that will be repeated later. Several hundred desperate people scrambled up out of the portholes, seeking refuge on the hull of the ship, where they waited for rescue. But just a few minutes later, the Empress could stay afloat no more, and sank to the bottom of the St. Lawrence River. Captain Kendall watched in despair as his ship, his first ever command, slipped under the surface. The RMS Titanic took 3 hours to sink. The elapsed time from the collision with the Storstad to the sinking of the Empress of Ireland was just 14 minutes. Frank Abbott was plucked out of the river by the Storstad. He later said that he saw Lawrence Irving and Mabel Hackney on the deck of the ship hugging each other. The bodies of the famous couple were never found. The body of a young girl was found on the banks of the St. Lawrence, 18 miles away from the collision site. The girl turned out to be 4-year-old Edith Hart. Edith's grandfather traveled to Quebec to find his family, where he provided a positive identification. Edith was the only member of the Hart family whose body was recovered. Another child, survivor Grace Hannigan, was 7 years old at the time and traveling with her parents Edward James Hannigan and Edith Hannigan, with the Salvation Army Group. Grace later recalled, "Father and I saw a flash of bright light through the porthole and felt the ship shake. Father said, 'The boat is sinking,' and we ran with Mother dressed just as we were. We climbed the stairs and went with Father to the railing. Then we were thrown into the water. I lost Mother and Father and never saw them again. I sank deep into the water. When I came back up, there was a piece of wood nearby. I hung onto it. Then I saw a man in a lifeboat and called to him to take me aboard. He grabbed me and pulled me into the lifeboat. There was also a woman hanging on to the piece of wood, but I did not see her after that." Survivors later reported that many of the Salvation Army passengers gave up their life jackets to other passengers, including Grace's father, Edward James Hannigan, whose body was later recovered and identified. His wife, Edith, sadly, was never recovered. Grace Hannigan was one of only four children to survive out of the 138 on board. Second Officer Roger Williams assisted passengers into lifeboats as the ship was sinking. At the end, he was forced into the water as the ship finally went down. His body was recovered and is buried at the Canadian Pacific Memorial in Pointe-au-Père, Quebec. Crew member William Clark worked in the engine room as a stoker. Just 2 years earlier, he performed the same duties on the Titanic. Clark miraculously survived both of these devastating shipwrecks. Clark recalled, "I was fireman on both the ships. It was my luck to be on duty at the time of both accidents. The Titanic disaster was much the worst of the two. I mean, it was much the most awful. The waiting was the terrible thing. There was no waiting with the Empress of Ireland. You just saw what you had to do and did it. The Titanic went down straight like a baby goes to sleep. The Empress of Ireland rolled over like a hog in a ditch." Captain Henry George Kendall survived the wreck. However, he was deeply emotionally affected for the rest of his life. Most likely, he had what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. Following an investigation, Kendall returned to England and rejoined the Royal Navy as senior officer on the Calgarian. The Calgarian was torpedoed in 1918 during World War I, but Kendall survived that as well. After the war, he served as the Marine Superintendent in England for Canadian Pacific until his retirement in 1939. He lived a quiet life in London and died in 1965 at age 91. We're going to drop anchor here just for a moment for an ad break. Survivors were taken to the nearby city of Rimouski, where they received medical attention. News of the ship sinking began making its way across the country and the whole world. 1,477 people left Quebec City on the Empress of Ireland. 1,012 lost their lives, including 840 passengers. That is eight more passengers than died on the Titanic. Here's Dan Conlon.
Losing 840 passengers, a high proportion of her passengers, more than died aboard Titanic. Titanic had enough time to at least get a lot of the passengers off, whereas Empress, so many people just died in their cabins or were trapped below deck. The crew who were on duty had a better shot because they were already awake and on deck on managing to get over the side. Titanic has more deaths, but Empress has more passenger deaths, and Empress is right up there in the league of kind of great ocean liner disasters.
Because of the massive loss of life, the Empress of Ireland is called Canada's Titanic. A public inquiry was launched 3 weeks later in Quebec City, headed by Lord Mercy, who also led the commission for the Titanic and the Lusitania. Officers from both ships testified, with each side accusing the other of wrongdoing and negligence. A Canadian newspaper wrote of the testimony, "If the evidence is to be believed, the Empress and the Storstad collided violently while lying motionless 2 miles apart." The Canadian public clearly put the blame on the Norwegian ship, and Captain Kendall's testimony echoed that sentiment. He testified that he ordered a full stop in the fog, and the Storstad made the mistake of changing its course while in dense fog. First officer on duty, Alfred Toftinus, testified he had first seen the green navigation light of the Empress, indicating its starboard side. However, As Toftinus claims, he then saw the green and the red lights, and then just the red, of the Empress, indicating a course change. It was at this point the fog enveloped both ships, and he and the other officers on the bridge believed the Empress intended a port-to-port passing. It is important to note that Captain Anderson still had not been notified of fog or an approaching ship. Toftinus went on to say, because of the fog, he ordered a turn to starboard to allow more space between the two ships, then ordered slow, and then ordered slow ahead. He continued slowly through the fog when the Empress came speeding out of the fog, as he claims, across the bow of the Storstad. The Commission of Inquiry had to weigh conflicting testimonies. If the testimony by Alfred Toftinus is to be believed, the Empress of Ireland would have changed course three times within a short duration while very close to shore, while in dense fog. This would explain the observation of the navigation lights, but an experienced captain would never make such maneuvers. While Captain Kendall was certainly experienced, this was his first voyage as captain of his own ship. Could he have made such a disastrous mistake? Possibly, but there was no other evidence of this other than the testimony of First Officer Toftinus. Many on board died in the wreck, and many of the survivors had no idea what happened. The commission ultimately decided to believe Captain Kendall's version of the story, perhaps because it was simply more likely, and placed the blame on the Storstad. In the 2005 documentary, The Last Voyage of the Empress of Ireland, investigator Dave Greener, along with marine engineer Bob McNair, professor of subsea engineering Colin McFarlane, and director of maritime studies at the University of Glasgow, Olaf Olsen, performed a simulation of the accident. Their results indicated a problem with Kendall's claim that the Empress was at a dead stop. Their simulation showed it would not be possible for the Storstad to be rotated in the reverse direction following the collision, if the Empress wasn't moving. They concluded the force of the Empress in motion is what caused the rotation of the Storstad. The tragedy of the Empress of Ireland is underscored by the speed at which she sank and the high death toll. A number of factors contributed to these. The Storstad was built with longitudinal bracing, making the ship very strong lengthwise in order to break through ice. These reinforcements made the Storstad a virtual battering ram and punctured right through the Empress of Ireland to a depth of 25 feet and ripped a hole 14 feet wide below the waterline. The water flooded the ship so quickly that it prevented the crew of the Empress from engaging any of the ship's emergency measures. The manual watertight doors couldn't be closed in time, and the ship listed to starboard too quickly for the lifeboats to be launched. Despite happening just 2 years after the Titanic, the sinking of the Empress of Ireland never achieved the same notoriety or fame, despite the massive loss of life.
Empress of Ireland sinks just before the commencement of World War I. So it's pushed from the headlines. It was huge news at the time, but it's pushed from the headlines by the guns of August and nations of Europe and the world slaughtering each other in the trenches. So it's overshadowed by that on one end, and then it's overshadowed on the other end by the big shipwreck 2 years earlier, Titanic, which is this great, highly symbolic, biggest ship in the world sinking on its maiden voyage full of celebrities. And Empress is kind of overshadowed by those two events. And so although she was big news at the time, she's kind of pushed away from public memory, doesn't get the focus of books and feature films that Titanic is. The fact that Empress sank so quickly in 15 minutes, you didn't have the kind of epic stories of chivalry or cowardice, or, you know, hard decisions to how to load the lifeboats. It was just this desperate struggle for survival that doesn't quite make for the big narrative. And it was a ship that also didn't have the Anglo-American sort of celebrity crowd that Titanic had. So you didn't have the richest man in the world. You didn't have a presidential aide, you know. You had some couple important authors and actors aboard returning from North American tours, but you didn't have the big celebrity power that, you know, makes a shipwreck iconic. So Empress really faded from the memories fairly quickly and became kind of a regional event, remembered in Quebec and remembered by the survivors of the grieving families of those who died. It was kind of in more recent years when the wreck was protected and its story started to be told a bit more, that the wreck has become better known. There's now a lovely museum in Rimouski that is just dedicated at Point Au Pair to the story of the Empress of Ireland. The Canadian Museum of History, you know, has this amazing collection, including the ship's bells, and they integrate parts of that into the permanent exhibit. And we talk about Empress Moore at the Canadian Museum of Immigration at Pier 21 because she played such a big pivotal role. You know, over 90 successful voyages, thousands and thousands of Canadian citizens came to Canada on that vessel, especially in Western Canada. Empress is remembered in like the provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta a lot, because there are so many people who have an ancestor came on that ship. Some people have projected there's as many as a million people who have a family connections to somebody who crossed an Empress of Ireland, because she was such a busy and successful ship for her years of operation in that peak period of North American migration just before World War I.
The wreck of the Empress of Ireland lies in the St. Lawrence River in about 40 meters of water. It rests on the bottom at a sharp angle on its starboard side, so much so that all the rooms on the starboard side are buried in the river bottom. The Empress rested undisturbed until she was rediscovered by divers in 1964. Like the Andrea Doria, diving the wreck of the Empress of Ireland is both difficult and dangerous. The waters of the St. Lawrence River are extremely cold, even in the summer, and the tidal currents of up to 5 knots often result in low visibility. Only expert divers should ever attempt this dive. However, those who have the training and expertise to make the dive will be treated to a large opening right through the middle of the ship. It was created by the salvage company hired by Canadian Pacific Railway to retrieve as much as possible from its investment, specifically the mail that was on board, the ship's safe, and silver bullion worth about $2 million in today's money. Still visible on the wreck are the ship's dining room, tables, chairs, light fixtures, and scattered personal items such as luggage. We will never know exactly what happened. However, we do know that Captain Kendall did not order the portholes closed upon departure from Quebec City, as regulations dictated. He also did not order the watertight doors closed until it was too late. And on the store stat, we have Captain Anderson asleep in bed while his ship was navigating through dense fog with an approaching ship in relatively narrow waters. There were mistakes made by the crews of both the Empress of Ireland and the Storstad. It is fair to assume this collision would never have happened in clear weather. The heavy fog which suddenly came upon the ships at that exact moment in time was the true culprit which took the lives of so many. That's going to do it for the Empress of Ireland episode. Thank you so much for listening. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by Rich Napolitano. That's me. And thank you so much to Dan Conlon for joining me for this episode. You can find him at the Canadian Immigration Museum at Pier 21 in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on his YouTube channel at Sean Secret. Please remember to follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Shipwrecks Pod. And also, you can find us at shipwrecksandseadogs.com on the web. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.